This is part two of a six-part series. The most recent ice age ended around 10,000 years ago, which presents a puzzle for America. It wasn't until the 1990s that scientists broadly agreed that the single point of human origin lay in Africa. At that time, anthropologists and geologists agreed that humans could not have crossed from Siberia to Alaska before 10,000 years ago, although some fossils uncomfortably suggested an arrival a millennium before that. The first arrival of humanity in the Americas is still hotly debated. The question of what constitutes evidence of human habitation continues to evolve with ongoing research. That date has recently taken a big jump backwards, though, with the discovery of human footprints in southern New Mexico from 23,000 years ago. We suspect that humans crossed from Asia to Alaska when the water level was much lower. Up until 7,000 or so years ago, they could have simply walked across. But this landscape would have been very cold and deep during that last ice age, only supporting bare subsistence for humans. People on the edge of survival could not have crossed the dozen or so completely frozen mountain ranges between Alaska and the rest of the continent. It seems clear that instead, humans traveled along the Pacific coast, all the way down the Americas. This is still an unproven hypothesis, but most of the evidence that would support it is most likely lost, or at least inaccessible, without more advanced underwater techniques. Their settlements would all be about 400 feet underwater today. These first Americans found a world teeming with some animals still common to the rest of the world, and others that had long since disappeared everywhere. One by one, they hunted these animals to extinction. It was a brutal lesson we are in the midst of learning again. Humans have immense power to disrupt fragile ecosystems. Larger animals tend to have a hard time adjusting to environment change. They live too long and reproduce too slowly to make fast genetic adjustments. Evolution, like geology, is very slow. Sometimes climate change can outpace it, and you end up with mass extinctions like we're seeing today. Slower generations generally means slower evolution. In this case, the environmental change they were experiencing was the arrival of a completely new, incredibly successful predator. Life simply didn't have time to adapt to this spear-throwing ape from Africa that was suddenly roaming their plains. That said, extinction, like adaptation, was slow. Already pushed to the edge of survival by global warming, the ice sheets that covered North America were melting and carving most of the large river valleys we see today. Animals could not adapt quickly enough to this new predator. This first wave of human-caused extinction foreshadowed more recent times, during which humans have eliminated living species at 100 to 1,000 times the normal rate of evolution. We know that by 23,000 years ago, there were humans living in New Mexico, and certainly earlier in the Americas. It took American populations then at least 10,000 years to eat the last cheetah. The American lion and ground sloth followed. Then went the mammoth, a large species of bison, the mastodon, the jaguar, and the stout-legged llama. The horse, an assortment of cats, wolves, and bears followed. We can only wonder how much history would have played out differently if some of these, notably the horse, had survived in some form, like cats, wolves, bears, and bison did. Instead, Native Americans had far fewer animals to domesticate, which accounted for some of the large lifestyle differences between Europe and the Americas. As in the rest of the world, human technology and social development spread up and down the continent, but crucially not between that continent and Afro-Eurasia. Americans created entirely new ecosystems with their plants. Corn is so unique that its exact origin and development are still hotly debated. As I've discussed a few times, domestication of plant life and careful management transformed the forests of North and South America. The triple crop bundle, of potatoes, corn, and beans created a surplus that fed vast cities in the Americas. Perhaps most incredibly, in many places and many times, the combination of hunting, gathering, farming, and ranching used by inhabitants of the Americas was sustainable, even for large cities. Something that can't be said for large cities in the rest of the world, and large cities today. In many cases, the humans of the Americas joined the apex predators of their ecosystems, rather than completely retooling the ecosystem, as is the case when forests are cleared for farmland.
And that's a lot of Native people all over this country. I know as we look at climate change, there's a movement coming from Native tribes to let them and their ways and their Native traditions actually lead these movements to combat climate change, because the way that they did live in harmony with the earth and caring for the earth first is really something to be modeled even today.
Mountain ecosystems can be particularly fragile. Life tends to adapt to drier, higher, colder climates by using less energy, eating less, moving less, and reproducing slower. This survival strategy makes mountain life fragile in the same way that large animals are fragile. A major and successful strategy for preserving these ecosystems was remaining transient. People rarely stayed at high elevation during the winter and hunted lightly when moving through these sparse environments. You can probably guess why I'm lingering on this detail. This low-impact mountain lifestyle continued for millennia. Different people with different languages and cultures no doubt inhabited the Colorado Rockies over these intervening centuries, and they left little trace. Much of the material culture was made of wood and skins, which weathered away. To the south, a large and vibrant civilization blossomed in the canyons of Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon. The ancient Pueblo culture created incredible cities carved into the rock from the 700s to the 1140s. But in the end, most were abandoned, probably due to changing climate. Sometime after 1000, a Numic-speaking people migrated from southeast California up the Colorado River. They inhabited the ancient Pueblos left behind and eventually reached the Four Corners area by 1500. I'm reminded of Herodotus passing through the great ruins of Nineveh in 400 BC and realizing just how ancient civilization is. American nations encountered the same phenomenon. By 1600, this group occupied most of Colorado. We call them the Ute. They call themselves the Nooch, meaning the mountain people. Ute is the name given to them by early Spanish settlers. The Ute believe they were chosen to live in the mountains. Their origin myth tells of how Coyote was given a bag of sticks by the Creator, who instructed him to carry the bag far away and not open it until he got there. Coyote, being young and foolish, couldn't wait and peeked inside.
Yakovich is a trickster for many tribes. So Yakovich used to always create chaos and problems. And the Creator gets tired, it's annoying. Oh, Puiwi, I'm tired. So he decides to go take a rest. And who do you think is watching all this time he's doing this? Yakovich. Yakovich is very curious. What's in the bag? What's in the bag? And he hears all kinds of sounds coming from the bag. Now he's really curious. What's in the bag? So he has a stone knife. And he cuts the bag. How many of you have stepped on an anthill? What happens? All the people started coming out, and Coyote tried to put them back in the bag. And there were so many people, he freaks out and runs away. Well, Sonoyev came back and seen his bag was empty, and he knew who had done what. He was bummed. He reaches inside the bag. There's only one more group of people, and it's the Ute people. And he says, Muiget, Dovach, We get Nutu, you are Ute people. We get Chichige, you are strong. And we'll be able to defeat all the rest. So I'm going to put you high over in the Rocky Mountains, high in the Uinta Mountains, and high in these Wasatch Mountains. And that's how we became known as mountain people.
Like all people, the Ute named the landscape, and it became the landscape of their mythology and religion. Pike's Peak was Tavakev, the Sun Mountain, a holy site and a major gathering place. The Garden of the Gods appears to have also been a major gathering place for bison hunts. The ubiquitous mountain springs represented the springing forth of life, be that ancestral or life force of the land. A lesser known but cherished spring was located high in the Yampa Valley, too cold to visit in winter, but a spot of relaxation in summer. There, Ute Indians bathed in a tepid, stinky sulfur spring and watched a geyser spray jet after jet of subterranean water into the river, glug glug glugging as it filled up each time. The Ute lived in wikiups, a structure of wood covered with grass and brush, which kept cool during the hot southwestern summers. In colder months, they retreated from the higher mountains to wikiups insulated with bark and hides. In the 1700s, they began to adopt the teepees of the Plains Indians. The Ute believe that human life is just one part of nature, not something distinct, as their European counterparts did. Everything from the rocks and grass to the water and sky are alive and animated with spirit. They believe life is best lived in alignment with the movements of the universe. They favor the right hand and the right side of the body as the sunwise direction. They have a gendered division of labor that historically included a third gender for those assigned male at birth that lived in female roles. For the better part of two centuries, the Ute were unperturbed by the arrival of Europeans in the Americas. The first major change to their way of life was the adoption of horses, which began in 1640 through trade with the Spanish and taming the descendants of feral Spanish horses, known as Mustangs. They thrived on the Great Plain, where the Equus Scoti, the American horse, roamed 10,000 years before. Always semi-nomadic, the Ute now traveled much further in the average year and carried around more stuff, more material culture. As a result, they could create more complex textiles and jewelry and accumulate much more of them. As horses became the common currency of the American plain, the Ute engaged in horse raids with the Plains Indians, the Apache, Arapaho, Cheyenne, Pueblo, Comanche, Kiowa, and Navajo. They continued to spread their culture north and west into Utah, hence the name, but did not project power onto the plains. By the 1820s, white Americans increasingly arrived in the Rockies to trap and trade. By the 1840s, beaver became endangered in Colorado. Their disappearance drained unique ecosystems that once dotted Colorado, beaver ponds. Beaver ponds provided much-needed food for animals all up and down the food chain, including humanity. Also in the 1840s, Colorado and most of the western states became an American territory at the conclusion of the Mexican-American War. While the Spanish and Mexican governments had rarely made incursions into the Ute land, Americans had every intention to farm, mine, inhabit, and terraform the West. One of the first acts of the U.S. Army, after capturing Santa Fe, was to send raiding parties to harass the Ute of New Mexico. Utes soon came in conflict with American settlers, as large parties of a strange new religious sect from upstate New York began arriving in the Salt Lake Basin. ¶¶ Only now did the Ute contract the Eurasian diseases that had so ravaged other populations in the Americas. After initial armed conflicts, in 1849, the Ute signed their first pact of friendship with the United States. It called for protection of American settlers on Ute lands, the establishment of American military posts, free passage for Americans, and the insistence that Ute, quote, cease the roving and rambling habits that have hitherto marked them as a people. In return, they were to receive unspecified donations, presents, and implements. This was an extension of the long-standing American policy of using American Indian gift-giving to obligate them into unequal treaties under the guise of sharing. In reality, Americans had proven again and again that land sharing was always a pretext for enough white settlers to move into an area to make the traditional American Indian lifestyles impossible. This new power structure became painfully relevant when a wealthy Irish baronet, Lord St. George Gore, led 40 friends and servants into what is now northwestern Colorado. Over the next 3 years, they killed 2,000 bison, 16,000 deer or elk, and 105 bears. It's estimated that he wasted somewhere around 1 million pounds of meat, a shocking act that the Ute considered a form of warfare, although they refrained from directly harassing Gore's party. Gore doesn't appear to have ever considered his crushing impact on the ecosystem or on the Ute. The Gore Mountain Range is named for him, despite evidence that he never laid eyes upon it. Attempts to change the name have faltered so far. In 1849, panners from California found gold in the Platte River, setting off a new wave of colonization. In 1858, a group of prospectors from Georgia set up camp at the confluence of Cherry Creek and Platte River and named their camp after their hometown of Auraria. Later that year, General William Larimer staked a claim on the other side of Cherry Creek, intending to speculate the land, not pan the rivers. He named his town Denver to try and impress the governor of the territory, James Denver, who, unbeknownst to Larimer, had already resigned his office. Denver doesn't seem to have ever had much affection for his namesake city, even when it became the capital of the state in 1876. He lived most of his life as a lawyer and politician in D.C. Gold in the Platte River led speculators upstream to a sacred mountain. White miners renamed the mountain after Zebulon Pike, a general and early explorer of Colorado. Within a few years, the mining camps of Boulder, St. Charles, Central City, Black Hawk, Georgetown, Leadville, and Idaho Springs were all established. Americans now had a commercial interest in the Southern Rockies, and the existing treaties with the Ute did not protect these intensive mining operations. By the 1860s, American negotiators had picked Chief Urey to become the negotiator for the Ute Confederation. Even though he only represented one group of Ute, American negotiators considered treaties signed with Urey to apply to all Ute. Urey was bilingual and an outspoken advocate for peace with the Americans, believing that warfare would never stem the tide of whites into Ute lands. After a series of flattering tours to D.C., he signed a treaty giving up Ute land on the eastern slopes of the Rockies. President Lincoln's personal secretary bragged,
"By its provisions, the Indian title is extinguished to one of the largest tracts of land ever ceded to the United States in a single treaty."
It was just the beginning of the land concessions. Increasingly brutal fighting broke out between the Mormons and the Ute. The Ute found it more and more difficult to live on land that Mormons were converting to ranch and farmland. When whites would harvest excess wood from the forests or graze some grassland clean, the Ute would demand repayment. The Mormons, considering the land theirs to do with what they pleased, often refused, and cycles of punitive raids broke out.
The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning. The Latter-day glory begins come forth.
Things came to a head in 1865 when a Ute war band under Chief Nooch, called Blackhawk jokingly by Brigham Young, began intensely raiding Mormon cattle and selling them to Americans further east. Many of these raids escalated into armed skirmishes, and the war remains the deadliest conflict in Utah's history. Despite requests from Mormons, the American government didn't send troops for 7 years because they considered Mormons to be rebels at best and had engaged in open battles with them prior to the Civil War. In 1872, the federal troops finally arrived, and the Ute accepted much diminished territory. The provisions of the treaty restricting Ute hunting and gathering were strictly enforced, while the provisions restricting white appropriation of land went unenforced. The sixth governor of the Territory of Colorado, Samuel Hitt Elbert, facilitated this treaty, which gave 3 million acres to the Americans to mine. In return, he got a 14er named in his honor. He's not the only Indian remover we honor in the names of our landscape. Back in 1864, the second territorial governor, John Evans, issued the following proclamation.
I, John Evans, governor of the Colorado Territory, do issue this my proclamation authorizing all citizens of Colorado to go in pursuit of all hostile Indians on the plains, to kill and destroy as enemies of the country, wherever they may be found, all such hostile Indians.
It's thought that this order led directly to the Sand Creek Massacre, and Evans was forced to resign afterwards. Sand Creek was a slaughter so horrific that even frontier Americans of the 1860s couldn't stomach it. Evans also has a 14er named in his honor. It would be exhausting to run down all the atrocities related to Colorado place names, but rest assured that Gore, Evans, and Elbert are only the most prominent. By now, the writing was on the wall. As white Americans moved into the remotest corners of the Rockies, they considered Indian removal to be an inevitability. The Boulder News announced that
an Indian has no more right to stand in the way of civilization and progress than a wolf or a bear.
And it's here that we truly begin the story of Steamboat Springs.
Thank you.